Good day and welcome to the American Constitution Society, What's Next? Reproductive Justice in the Wake of Hobby Lobby and McCollin Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mrs. Zanell October. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Noah. Good afternoon. I'm Zanell October, Director of Student Chapters here at the American Constitution Society. Thank you for joining us for today's call, What's Next? Reproductive Justice in the Wake of Hobby Lobby and McCollin. Please note that today's call is being recorded. We will provide the recording to those who RSVP'd after the call. This is the first in our summer series of What's Next calls, where experts in our network discuss the past U.S. Supreme Court term. 0.5 California CLE credit is available for this and all of the calls in the series. Please email Katie O'Connor at koconnor@acslaw.org to get credit. We will invite you to ask questions at the end of the call. Judging from the RSVP list, we'd like to say welcome to several new friends to the American Constitution Society. For those of you not familiar with ACS, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. We're fortunate that today's speaker is part of that network. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. If you support these efforts and are not a formal part of our network, we encourage you to become a national member of ACS today. And now I'm pleased to introduce today's speaker, Louise Vellin, Deputy Legal Director of the ACLU and the Director of its Center for Liberty. Louise also recently appeared on a panel at the ACS National Convention last month. Louise, please enlighten us.
Thank you so much, Zanell, and thank you everybody for joining. I'm really delighted to be here, and I'm always delighted to do anything as with ACS. I'm a proud card-carrying member. It would be nice to be talking about something a little bit more upbeat, shall I say, than looking back at the Supreme Court and what's up for women in reproductive justice, but here's the task I have. As my boss, the ACLU legal director, said at the end of the term, his sort of walk-away theme was, it was a bad year for women. So I'm going to talk about two of the cases, the Hobby Lobby and McCollin. I'm also going to mention the recent episode, we'll just call it, with Wheaton College as way of talking about this. So first, Hobby Lobby. I'm going to go through basically what the court did and then kind of give you my take on that and then do the same with McCollin. I'm sure most of you already know the story, but what was at issue there was for-profit businesses, a chain of arts and crafts store and a woodcraft company, saying that providing insurance to their employees that covered all methods of contraception violated their religious liberty. I just want to note, the cases in the Supreme Court have gotten a ton of attention, but this is just one piece of the many moments of conversations about religious liberty in America and whether compliance with laws that prohibit discrimination violates the religious liberty of different constituencies. But in this case, what the plaintiffs were arguing primarily was that compliance with the federal rule violated their rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That's a federal statute, and it's a federal statute against which federal laws are measures. It doesn't apply to the states. They also raised a constitutional claim, but the constitutional claim wasn't addressed by the Supreme Court, and you know, part of that is you look at statutory claims first, and the other is constitutional claim is a loser, frankly, for reasons I can explain in the question and answers if you want. It's important to remember this is a statutory case. It's incredibly important because that means that Congress could fix the problem. Obviously, that might require us to have a different Congress that was really capable of fixing problems, but it does mean that there's at least an opportunity for a legislative response to this. So there are four core steps the court had to go through first. There was a question about whether these for-profit businesses constituted people for purposes of the statute. Could a for-profit corporation, did Congress envision that a for-profit corporation could be somebody who is asserting a religious freedom claim? It's a really big deal. It's a big question. The courts had never before ruled. Obviously, what the court ruled here was that for-profits were persons for purposes of the statute. The court in several places, you know, emphasizes that the people before us, these closely held corporations, are persons. I notice an aside, I don't read their language as limited necessarily to closely held, except that closely held are what was before them. Their logic might go beyond closely held, but the question really before them was corporations that were closely held. point was heavily contested in particular by the Justice Department, heavily contested in terms of what did Congress contemplate, how is it that businesses can exercise religion, what does it mean to say, in essence, that the owner's interests then constitute the interests of the corporation, where normally the whole purpose of a corporation is to separate from the owners. But the court, in a pretty lengthy discussion written by Justice Alito, says they count. Frankly, I wasn't surprised. I was at the argument, and at the argument there was much concern about a broad ruling that said that corporations wouldn't be persons, in particular because of its implications for businesses like kosher delis and whether they would then be without standing under the federal statute to challenge rules that governed how meat was prepared, for example. But, okay, step one, court goes through that one. Second question is, if you're a person, does this act in fact constitute under the statute a substantial burden on the exercise of your religion? Again, seriously contested, we at the ACLU, for example, are steadfast defenders of religious liberty, and we said this was not a substantial burden. The burden on the corporations was just too attenuated. The corporations are buying insurance that then is used by women when they make decisions ultimately with their doctor. There were intervening factors too far from the act to which the corporations objected, which is contraception. Obviously, Justice Alito wasn't deeply moved by that argument, and two things were noteworthy. Extreme deference in the decision to the claims by the corporations that this constitutes a substantial burden. Alito says it's not for us to say that their religious beliefs are mistaken or insubstantial. I note that traditionally courts have refused to question whether or not beliefs are sincere, but the question of whether a burden is substantial has been one that I think the courts have much more readily addressed. Not so here, extreme deference. Second, in finding that there is a substantial burden, the majority through Justice Alito says, look, the government, they provided exemptions, they provided accommodations. They wouldn't have to do that unless they actually thought somebody was burdened. So that helps, that reinforces our view that this constitutes a substantial burden. Third question. Now that there's a burden, the question is there a compelling state interest? Now we get to the government side. Does the government side outweigh the burden on the parties? Majority, we're just going to assume that there's a compelling state interest. The court does not address, does not speak to in the question about whether there really was a compelling interest in women's health or public health or ending discrimination. It goes on to the question of whether the government has acted in the way that is least restrictive. And the majority says, no. The government, through Health and Human Services, hasn't shown that it doesn't have other means of addressing its interests, other means of ensuring that women have contraception, other means of ensuring that we have contraception without burdening the religious freedom. And the court says, tosses out two examples of things the government could do. One is they could just assume the cost. The government could just pay for it. And they have these discussions that I find rather unbecoming, that this would surely be a small cost in the grand scheme of the cost of the ACA. Second, the government has already shown that they can figure out different ways to accommodate. Why, look at the accommodation they had for nonprofits. This is a side note with what the government did for the nonprofit religiously affiliated entities is say, you don't have to personally provide the insurance if you sign a form. And you send that to your insurer, then your insurer is just going to have to pick up all the administration, notify your employees, pay for the cost. And it was the government's way of trying to accommodate and take care of or address some of the concerns raised by the religious nonprofits while still ensuring coverage. So the administration says, I mean, not the administration, the majority says, you have this other way. Why couldn't you just extend the accommodation to the for-profit businesses? And then the majority also goes on to say, we're not opening up the floodgates. Everybody's running around saying that if we rule this way, the skies will fall. That's not it. We're only addressing contraception here. This decision doesn't mean that anybody who comes in and says, I don't want to provide vaccines will win. It doesn't mean that people who want to discriminate in hiring will win. So that's the majority. Kennedy concurs really to say, to sort of put his stock more in the accommodation and say the question of government paying doesn't seem like such a great idea. He goes on also to say that there is a compelling state interest, and the dissent, I'll just say what they say, is whatever the majority says, not. Dissent goes through and contests everything that the majority says. So my quick assessment is this decision is unprecedented in a whole bunch of ways. It's unprecedented in that it's the first time ever that the Supreme Court has said that an employer can invoke its religious beliefs to deny benefits that are guaranteed its employees by law. It's the first time the Supreme Court has done something like this to say that an institution can invoke its beliefs so as to impose burdens on other people. It's quite remarkable. Second, it's unprecedented, I think, in terms of how it treats substantial burden. I think it's probably the most troubling aspect of the decision if we think about future implications, at least in the context of religious claims. I just go back, the court was incredibly deferential. If the court is that deferential, it means that you very quickly, almost automatically, get to the question of the government having to prove a compelling state interest. That's not how traditional strict scrutiny works. Third, I think of its discussion of the compelling state interest a little bit as what if elephants could fly. It does seem that there would have to be a higher standard than just to say the government could simply pay for this, even if there's sort of no prospect, sort of readily imaginable about how the government might do that. And finally, I think that this decision is deeply troubling to me as a person who's worked in the field of reproductive rights for almost two decades now, more than two decades, in the sense that it is another case of what I refer to as exceptionalism. Exceptionalism as in special rules when we think about women and reproductive rights and equality. The majority goes out of its way to say, the opinion is limited. Things might be different for other forms of healthcare. Things might be different for other forms of discrimination. We've seen that playbook before. Abortion has been treated as sort of in a world unto itself. Women's questions of pregnancy have been treated into a world unto itself, and now we have contraception and women continue to be treated in a world unto themselves even in the 21st century. Broad implications, the federal statute, so many of it may have implications for what happens, for example, with ENDA, other non-federal laws addressing non-discrimination in the LGBT context, but the compelling state interest question will always be different. Similarly, in the states, in terms of the many claims of religious freedom as a way to avoid compliance with non-discrimination acts protecting LGBT people, the federal RFRA doesn't bind interpretations of similar state laws. Those questions are going to be worked out in the legislatures and in the state courts. And again, I think the courts are going to look at the state interests each time differently, assess each one in and of itself. And that's where I do worry about the exceptionalism. Next happy topic, McCullen. I'll probably be more restrained. I just have to state right off that the ACLU filed a brief in that case on behalf of neither party, just given our own particular balancing of free speech and reproductive rights considerations. What was at issue in McCullen was a Massachusetts statute that provided a free zone, a 35-foot buffer around facilities that provided abortion services. Massachusetts adopted this zone after having had a different statute in place to try to protect clinics known as what was floating buffer. These are all sort of complicated. I find them hard to visualize without kind of walking around. Within 18 feet of a clinic entrance, you could not approach somebody within 6 feet. You could be within closer than 6 feet. I could be right next to you, but then I couldn't sort of walk alongside you and be closer unless you gave consent. So it created what was thought of as like a buffer. I would have a little bubble around myself as I walked in. If I wanted to say stay back, you'd have to stay back in those 18 and a half feet. The state found that method wasn't sufficiently protective for its interest, and so they adopted the buffer zone. The court, in a unanimous decision, strikes the 35-foot buffer. When it does, it does a few things that are sort of interesting. I mean, one, the court says that the statute is content neutral. That means it wasn't discriminating based on the content of the speech. It says it wasn't viewpoint neutral. There's a debate about that within the court. But it says it's neutral because what's being regulated is like where you are and what you're doing, not literally what you're saying. And that matters because depending on whether it's content neutral or not, what the government is held to justify the restriction is different. So content neutral, there's less of a burden on the government than if it were content based. Once the court determines it's content neutral, the question is whether the regulation is narrowly tailored to serve a significant government interest. The provision can't burden substantially more speech than necessary to further the government's legitimate interest. Those interests, and the court said these were legitimate, safety, free flow of traffic, women's access to reproductive health care. But the court said that this provision was not narrowly tailored, and the court talks at great length about the incredible importance of discourse on the public sidewalks. It talks about the importance of face-to-face conversations, and it talks extensively about the claims put forward by the plaintiff about engaging in what she referred to as sidewalk counseling and her success in convincing women not to proceed with abortions where she's been able to engage in face-to-face counseling. So in reaching the conclusion that this isn't narrowly tailored, the court says a couple things. One, they say the Massachusetts law is exceptional. The court says it's the only state with such a law. It says you all have a legitimate state interest, but you have to try other things first. You could have tried your own state harassment law. You could have tried laws against obstruction. You could have tried the federal law prohibiting obstruction. We courts say it looks like you have a problem only at one location. If that's true, then you need to address that one location instead of engaging in providing for a state statute that covers all the different locations. And you have to really show us that those other methods didn't work. And here we don't see that you had a lot of arrests under that old statute. We're not really convinced that that other statute didn't work for you. Your only real claim, says the court, sort of to Massachusetts, is you say it's a lot easier, more efficient to enforce a buffer zone, something that bright line. That's not enough where speech is on the other side. Look, I'm talking to you from the ACLU, which filed a brief on behalf of neither side, but I have several things to say about this. One is the tone of the opinion from the standpoint of somebody who's been to a lot of clinics is deeply infuriating in the sense that the tone of the opinion is to suggest that everything that happens at the clinic is peaceful and friendly and sidewalk chats. It doesn't in any way sort of address the reality. You can say speech is happened with Skokie. This speech is incredibly offensive, but we have to protect it. This is incredibly hard what happens at clinics, but we're not willing to go this far. And I am quite curious, and I will wonder for many, many years, I think, why our friends didn't say anything about that. Second, the court's decision, I think our friends joined this decision in part because it leaves open, at least in theory, the prospect of relief. I say in theory because I think meeting the standards that the court sets out are incredibly difficult. Third, the decision in some sense is not totally consistent with reality in terms of how hard it is for police to actually enforce those statutes. It's incredibly complicated to sort of figure out whether people violate a 6-foot boundary. And the court attempts to distinguish this, but there is a buffer zone outside the court. There are buffer zones outside polling places, and then there are sort of makeshift buffer zones outside other kinds of protests. And in part because there's just been so much activity in abortion, abortion has been regulated differently to try to provide protection. And that's why this issue comes to the court more often and presents more challenges. And then I think, if anything, we wind up with perhaps some different standards that come out as a result or more strict scrutiny of what happens because there is more regulation outside the clinics of abortion than there are in other areas. So I would leave by saying in both places, both decisions, I think there's been insufficient attention to how important the interests of the state were in both cases. And again, as the ACLU, you can come out in a different place. You can come out where the court did, perhaps in the buffer zone case, but you still might butt acknowledging the harm. Similarly, in the contraception case, there is insufficient attention, I think, to the harm that has befallen women. And then I must mention Wheaton College. The court in Hobby Lobby on Monday says one of the reasons we're going to let Hobby Lobby not comply is because we think you have another at least restrictive means, which is the accommodation on Thursday, the court enjoins the accommodation in the context of a case brought by a nonprofit. So in that instance, I think we just have to sort of wonder what the court is really doing. And I have genuine questions about how the court understands its sort of institutional role or its institutional integrity in that context. These aren't even the $6 million cases coming to the court again also soon, which are the ones about abortion regulations. So tough year for women. Not sure that 2015 will be better, but let's hope so. I guess, ask that it be opened up for questions now.
Thank you.
Noah, may you give the instructions.
And if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. Once again, that's star 1 for questions.
I'm sure nothing I said was so clear that you don't have questions, especially when I had to talk at the speed of light.
Oh, they're coming in now, don't you worry. go ahead
and we do have a question from Sarah Wunsch.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, so Sarah's here, and this is also actually Jesse Rossman, here at the ACLU of Massachusetts. And one of the things that we were looking at as these decisions were coming out was also the Harris decision that came out last week with respect to the unionization of home care workers. And we, sort of in our affiliate and talking about it internally, saw that as an additional attack with trying to control not just women's reproductive rights choices and control over their own body, but also their ability to fully participate in the marketplace in an equal and fair way and to be able to provide for their families. And we were just wondering, Louise, if that was something that you all had been looking at, if you had any thoughts about how that could also sort of be a piece in the greater puzzle of what was happening to women in the court this term.
I thank you for making that point, and I agree, and I know that Steve has made that point with reporters. I mean, that the question of the home health care workers is a question about an industry that's overwhelmingly, like almost entirely women. And so it was another moment where women's interests were particularly shafted. Women's interests not particularly well attended to by the court. And I'll just add one other thing, right? It is striking. If you haven't read it yet, you really might want to sort of look at these decisions in terms of their dissents. I mean, the Wheaton College order that came out on Thursday, the dissent are the three women. I mean, I don't know what happened to Breyer. I don't know what happened to Kennedy, but I in particular don't know what happened to Breyer and why he went to the majority there as opposed to staying with the dissent as he did in Hobby Lobby. But thank you for making that point.
We'll take our next question from Sarah Brathman.
Hello. Good afternoon. So in the Hobby Lobby case, the court held that it only applied to closely held companies, but there are a rash of different definitions going around about what exactly is a closely held company, whether it's by an IRS decision, state, statutory, et cetera. I was wondering if you could discuss what the feeling is on how closely held will be interpreted by the lower courts.
I might share an excellent question. I probably share your interest in seeing how that will play out. I don't know how that one will play out. I will say there's a couple things. One is the court talks about closely held, but as I said before, I don't think its reasoning could apply more broadly. And I have wondered, I don't know whether I wondered whether the administration will try to issue anything to say this is how it should be defined or this is what we're imagining it is defined as in some fashion, right? I don't know what fix the administration or Congress may try to propose to address the decision. There was a bill dropped just today to try to address the situation to say that the for-profit companies, that employers can't deny their employees benefits based on their religious beliefs, notwithstanding RIFRA, right? Again, this would be a congressional fix. But I think we'll just have to wait and see. And I am not in any way an expert on what the differences are in the different kinds of state statutes to fully appreciate what the differences are and therefore what the parameters might be and how to work that.
And we'll take our next question from Leora Harpaz.
Yeah, I was wondering if there are any circumstances in which the application of RFRA to closely held corporate to accommodate the religious beliefs of closely held corporations would be limited by the Establishment Clause.
There were certainly briefs. There was a brief, another great question. So there was a brief put forward by Fred Geddix and some other religion professors. Fred Geddix, first of all, he's just a gem of a guy, teaches at Brigham Young University, and they put out a brief that said that if the court were to do what it did here, it would violate the Establishment Clause because the government would then be shifting the cost of the employer's religious beliefs onto third parties, and that that was inconsistent with the Establishment Clause. And, you know, in one conversation I had with Fred, it's like saying that you have to pay for your neighbor's religion. The government couldn't come and tell you had to pay for my ability to exercise my religion. And that's in essence what granting the exemption was doing. That argument did not seem to have, it was not an argument that the government had advanced, but it's also not an argument that got traction here. I think given this court that if there were to be a full, a straight up, straight on Establishment Clause challenge, it would be heartwarming, but I think not successful. Establishment Clause arguments, though, you know, might be considerations if similar questions arise under state laws. Many states have their own contraception equity laws. Many states have their own religion provisions in their state constitutions. State constitutions can be interpreted differently and more liberally than federal constitutions. So arguments like that advanced by Geddix and others in the Supreme Court could still be arguments, depending on your state law, that might be advanced in your state courts.
And we'll take our next question from Katie O'Connor.
Hi. I'm wondering, why do you think the court in McCullen chose to deem it a content-neutral law? Was that just to get the liberals to sign on to the decision so that it was unanimous?
I actually think it is a content-neutral law. So, look, they might have done it because they actually thought it was true. Conservatives might have done it because they knew they were going to win anyway. And the court may have done it because Roberts thought it was important somehow. I mean, Roberts has said in the press, right, to be concerned about the perception of the court as political and that it will lose its respect if that's true, and to have tried in many instances to get a unanimous opinion. So maybe it was a deal cut, but I also genuinely think it was in fact content neutral. That said, I still really would like to know why people like Ginsburg and Sotomayor or nobody wrote at least to say that the environment outside the clinic was different from how it's portrayed in the majority opinion.
And at this time, I'd like to turn the call back over to Zanel October for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you very much, Noah, and thank you very much, Louise. Having no more questions in the queue, we'll go ahead and conclude here. But we want to really say thank you for joining us today, Louise, and to all of the participants on today's call. If you haven't yet RSVP'd for future calls, please do so, everyone. The next one up in the series is next week, Tuesday, July 15th at noon Eastern Time. It's What's Next, Hall v. Florida and the Future of Death Penalty Jurisprudence, featuring Stephen Bright, President and Senior Counsel of the Southern Center for Human Rights. You will not want to miss him. Thank you, and this concludes today's call.
And this does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.